The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. So, I wasn't here the last couple of Mondays, so I wasn't able to follow my the series of talks I gave this fall directly. I gave a series of talks here on the five hindrances. And the five hindrances are the, in the teachings of the Buddha, the five qualities or activities of the mind the Buddha focuses on the most as the, what interferes with meditation, interferes with knowing what's, knowing our own good, it interferes with concentration. Sometimes it's said the five hindrances are qualities that blind us. So when we can be hindered or blinded, obscured, limited by very intense preoccupation with desire, is one. We can be hindered by very strong preoccupation with ill will or aversion. We can be hindered by being caught up in states of sloth and torpor. We can be hindered, or the luminosity of the mind can be obscured by being caught up in restlessness. And also the last one is doubt. So these are called the five hindrances. So I gave this fall, I gave a whole series of talks on those. And I wanted to cap that series of talks off with a one evening talk on a list the Buddha gave, which is the not the parallel list, but the complementary list to the five hindrances. And this is the list called the seven factors of awakening, the seven factors of enlightenment. So on one hand, the hindrances are these qualities that darken the mind. The factors of awakening are what lighten up the mind. The five hindrances are what obscures our knowing what is the best for us, knows what's beneficial for us. The seven factors of awakening help us to see clearly what is beneficial for us, what is best for us. So, for example, if many people have been caught up in a strong sensual desire, sensual desire that felt so good, how could something that felt so good be so wrong, is the saying people say. And so it feels good in the moment, but then for years afterwards we regret that evening, that night. And how, what was I thinking of? So we didn't really see what was best for us, what was beneficial for us. So the desire can kind of obscure that. And the seven factors of awakening is what helps us see what is beneficial and to act accordingly. So these two are complementary. And as the five hindrances wane, then the seven factors of awakening wax. And it's a beautiful movement to have these beautiful qualities of heart and mind be developed and grow in us. So the seven factors of awakening, I'll go over them a little bit more this evening, but to name them here, they're mindfulness. First one is mindfulness. The second one is investigation. The third is effort or energy. The fourth is joy. The fifth is tranquility, serenity. The sixth is concentration. And the seventh is equanimity. So one hand we have the five factors, five hindrances. On the other hand, we have the seven factors of awakening. The bridge between those two is, for those of you who can put up with it, another list. And that's the list of the four foundations of mindfulness. So to practice mindfulness, which happens also to be the first factor of awakening, but to practice mindfulness is the bridge. Mindfulness is one of the ways to get pulled out of the swamps of the five hindrances and into the secure, stable ground of the seven factors of awakening. So we learn to practice mindfulness. Practice mindfulness of the body, being connected to our body here, in a kind of different kind of way than we're connected, kind of a different way. We're connected to our body in such a way that wisdom has a chance to arise. We're connected to our body differently than when we're consumed with sensual passion, and we feel very connected to the body, thank you. And, you know, that's the whole point. But you know, it's kind of like maybe surface body, the sensual body. Whereas when we're connected to the body through mindfulness, it's a much deeper, more grounded, inhabited form of the body, mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the mind, really know what's going on in the mind, the states of the mind, and then mindfulness of the activity of the mind. So as we become more mindful and more present for our experience, we start seeing with greater acuity what is actually going on in our mind. And one of the things we start seeing is how the mind gets caught up, how the mind gets preoccupied. So we start seeing, oh, look at that. I'm really caught up in desire. I'm caught up in aversion, anger. I'm caught up in restlessness and doubt. To really see, that, oh, look at that. When really we see that clearly, one of the things that most people feel is they start feeling, this is not very, it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good to have my mind held hostage by these very strong energies. I get pulled around. My vision of what I see in the world, my perception of the world is colored by this. The choices I make is affected by this. When I sit down to meditate, my mind spins off. It doesn't feel so good. And you kind of feel that. It's not like a difficult thing to see. It just kind of doesn't feel very nice. As the mindfulness grows and we see these things more clearly, then this, we kind of step out of the orbit of preoccupation. We step out of the gravitational pull of thinking about what we desire, thinking about what we hate, thinking about our confusion, our restlessness, thinking about what we have doubts about. Rather than being locked into those kinds of concerns, the mindfulness helps to pull us out, unlock us from it, pull us out of the quicksand of them, and put us on dry ground, stable ground, so we can see much more clearly. And it's a remarkable movement to feel the movement of the mind going from being caught to really being free. Not free momentarily, where you kind of get pulled back in again quickly, but the mind has a stability in its freedom from preoccupation. Some people will describe a mind like that as being luminous, being expansive, being light, both in terms of weight and also in terms of luminosity. It can feel very satisfying. It can feel very soft, stable. So a variety of things. So as we kind of start, the mindfulness becomes strong enough that we're no longer pulled into our preoccupations, then mindfulness starts getting stronger and stronger. And mindfulness is the first factor of awakening. Mindfulness is considered to be a very simple factor of mind. It's a or being. It's often called a presence of mind. You bring a presence of mind to what is happening in the present moment. So when you say someone, you know, there's a certain kind of someone had a, they lost their presence of mind. I mean, they weren't really present for what was going on. So mindfulness meets our experience and is present for it in some kind of quality way, whether it's the experience of our breath or it's the experience of meeting a friend. There's a kind of sense of being present for the experience, bringing presence to it, and really sensing, feeling, holding it in our experience. As that develops, as the mindfulness gets stronger, the mind is able to start making seeing differences, making distinctions. And it's able to see the difference between, for example, being caught up and not being caught up. It can see the difference between clinging to something and not clinging to something. It can see the difference between resisting experience, bracing ourselves against some experience, and not doing that. It can see the difference between judging and being critical versus being allowing or compassionate or kind. It can start seeing the difference. And the primary meaning in the teachings of the Buddha of the second factor of awakening, investigation, is the ability to make distinctions between what is healthy for us to do and what is not. In other words, to help place us in enough presence of mind to see what's going on inside our mind, inside our hearts, to see where we have some choice about what we pick up and what we leave alone, between what we pick up and what we let go of. So say you're sitting meditating, and it can be something very simple. You say you're sitting here meditating, and you notice that when you put your shoes in the shoe rack, there were some really nice shoes. The Ducati shoes. Those are famous these days, right? The Ducati, how do you pronounce it? I just saw it in the paper. Ducati shoes. It's what was offered to President Bush in Iraq. These have apparently selling very well now. And anyways, you see some wonderful pair of shoes there sitting on the shoe rack. And so you sit down and meditate, and after meditating for 5 minutes, you start thinking about shoes. Wouldn't it be great to have a nice pair of shoes? I wonder what kind of shoes I should have. Maybe I could trade shoes with that person. So you're sitting there meditating, right? Are you meditating? No. You spent 10, 15, 20 minutes, years, something long period of time kind of thinking about shoes or something comparable. But hopefully, since you're doing mindfulness, at some point, you notice that. Wait a minute. I didn't come here to think about what kind of shoes to buy. I don't think that it actually doesn't feel so good to be caught up in thinking about shoes. There's a difference between being caught up in shoes, thinking about shoes, and not. There's a difference between being caught up in shoes and being present. That's a very simple distinction. And in seeing that difference, it's a very simple choice that the mind can make. I don't think so. That's enough of shoes for tonight. I'll stop thinking about shoes. So there's a whole, that's just a silly example, but there can be a whole series of things, ways in which the mind gets caught up in things. It could be that you're sitting here meditating and your shoulders are tense. And so your mind starts spinning out. Oh, what was I doing today? And it's really because of those people that I feel tense now. And what a terrible person I am for having tense shoulders. And I'm in a meditation center. And I shouldn't be tense. And so you start seeing, because the mindfulness is strong, see, the mind is doing this. The mind is having those kinds of thoughts. It's a world of difference between seeing that that's happening and having it happen and not see it. It's a world of difference between being swept away by those kinds of thoughts versus saying, oh, no, thank you. I'll leave it alone. I'll let go of it. So it's a very simple distinction. Oh, look at that. My mind is doing a certain kind of activity here. I can see what it's going off to do. And I can see it's not beneficial for me to do that. It's not the purpose I have set in mind for myself. And so I'm going to let go of that. I'm going to return to some sense of presence, to the breath, to here. So that sense, that ability to make those distinctions, very simple distinctions, is likened to wisdom. It's very close to wisdom in Buddhism. And as we make those very simple distinctions, it supports the mindfulness. The mindfulness can get stronger. Because you're more likely to choose those things that keep you here and present in a clear way. And this ability to make these kind of wise distinctions is almost a natural function of the mind. It's not any different, not any different perhaps than, you pull your hand off the stove when it's hot. You just do it, right? So you see these very simple things. Oh, no thank you. I don't go there. So mindfulness gets stronger. As mindfulness gets stronger, the ability to make distinctions gets stronger. At this point, some people find that their enthusiasm for doing the practice increases. They can really see, oh, this is really great. I can make a difference. These little distinctions make a real difference. And being present feels really good. It feels really good to be present. It feels a lot better than being caught up. And I have some ability to choose here. So I feel empowered. And so there's greater willingness to engage in putting effort into the practice. Okay, let's be mindful here. Let's do it. Let's really do it more. So energy, effort, enthusiasm grows. One applies oneself more. Some people will talk about almost like chi arising. A sense of energy will arise. It's really remarkable to sit down and meditate and feel a rising of energy within the body that can almost keep you upright, by itself. Especially it's special after a period of being very tired and the body keeps collapsing. Wow, the energy, the mindfulness is really strong and just really there. As the effort enthusiasm arises, the mindfulness gets stronger, the investigation gets stronger, so this all feeds itself. At some point, the enthusiasm and the engagement leads to something that in Buddhism is called, is the Buddhist word, not an English word, Buddhist word is piti. P-I-T-I. And it's usually translated as joy. Sometimes it's rapture. And at some point a sense of joy arises. In the sense that it arises from energy and enthusiasm, some people translate it as zeal. A sense of zeal, kind of joyful energy perhaps. But a sense of joy arises, and the joy can be quite beautiful. It can be subtle, it can be quite strong, sometimes it can be quite intense. But it's kind of, I like to think of it as being the joy, or delight, or satisfaction, well-being, that can come when you're really absorbed in some activity. I hope that all of you have had some experience in your life of doing something, reading a book, doing a craft, playing an instrument, doing some sports, exercise or something. And after a while, really getting into it and getting absorbed in it, and the absorption in it, it just feels joyful, delightful, kind of like play. So at some point, meditation, as we get more and more absorbed, more engaged and involved, so more of us is involved in it, that absorption gives rise to a certain kind of joy. I'm almost repeating myself. It's not a foreign thing to many people. Some people, if they're working on some craft, can be so absorbed in what they're doing, they don't know what time it is. Time goes really fast, perhaps. Someone can even call their name, they don't even hear it. They don't notice a lot of things around them. And it just feels really good, really delightful, delighted to be there. So that happens in meditation as well. As that sense of satisfaction and joy arises, that again is a feedback that supports mindfulness. Wow, this mindfulness is great. I'll do more of it. And the mindfulness gets stronger. As the mindfulness gets stronger, the ability to make more and more subtle distinctions increases. And more importantly, the ability to have more choice around those distinctions becomes greater. Because one thing to see, oh, I'm caught up here. Yeah, it's not good for me. I should let go of it. Let go. Come on, let go. Come on, now. And, you know, mind often doesn't cooperate. But as the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, the mind gets softer and more flexible, more adaptable, and more willing to kind of let go of these things. As the joy becomes stronger, becomes more part of the practice, that at some point gives rise to tranquility, to serenity. there's something about having a sense of well-being in meditation that lets us relax and lets the body relax in a deep way. And a profound feeling of peacefulness can settle in throughout the body. It's really almost a physical embodied feeling of peacefulness, of settledness, of tranquility, of relaxation. It can feel very pure, very clean feeling. Which then inspires the mindfulness. Wow, this is really good. And the clarity of the tranquility supports greater clarity in the mindfulness. Then, when we start getting more relaxed, we have the joy, the sense of well-being, and the relaxation, then it becomes a lot easier to become concentrated. Some of you have been trying to get concentrated for a long time, and you're wondering why it doesn't work. So it's hard to get concentrated if you don't have some sense of well-being, some sense of established in mindfulness, and some sense of enthusiasm for what you're doing, and some sense of well-being and relaxation. So some people who develop concentration will try to do what they can to develop some sense of inner well-being first and a sense of relaxation. The last thing you want to do if you're going to develop concentration is strive for concentration. bear down, tighten up. It's more like concentration has a lot to do, meditative concentration has a lot to do with letting go, relaxing. Why concentration is important in Buddhist practice is it's kind of like the principle of a tripod. If you have a telescope and you want to look at the moon, you don't hold the telescope in your hands because it wiggles too much. Don't have stability to look at something so far away. So you put the telescope on a tripod, and then you have stability and you can see clearly. So the same thing with our inner life. The mindfulness becomes so much more penetrating when it has when it's standing on the tripod of concentration. Function of concentration is to create tremendous stillness and stability so that the insight, the looking, can go deep down into the mind and see kind of some of the deeper workings of the mind that we often don't see in our day-to-day life. As we start seeing the working of our mind more clearly, and as the concentration gets stronger, it feeds back to mindfulness, and all this keeps developing, our ability to make distinctions continues, and our ability not to pick things up, leave things alone, becomes stronger. All these things together translates at some point to an increased equanimity. And equanimity is considered the crown jewel of Buddhist emotions. For those of you who have a strong sense of meditative equanimity, it can seem rather strange to call it the crown jewel of Buddhist emotions. It seems kind of like maybe aloof or cold or indifferent. There's a variety of different associations people have with equanimity that gives it a little bit of bad flavor. But the reason it's a crown jewel is that it's so sublime. It's one of the most satisfying emotional or mental states that a person can experience when it's really, really strong, meditative equanimity. And and the descriptions of it don't really do justice to what that quality is. But it's when the mind is completely balanced and in no way inclined to go forward towards something or away from something. When the mind is not inclined to pick anything up or reject anything. The mind is not liable to criticize anything, want anything, not want anything. It's just willing to be equanimous or balanced or non-reactive to whatever is happening. It's a very sublime, satisfying, clean, pure feeling of non-reactivity. Kind of something like that. So those are the seven factors of awakening. It's mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. If you have a greenhouse and you have curtains over the greenhouse, it gets hot, dark, and wet in there. All kinds of slime, mold, and things you don't want will grow. But if you pull the curtains on the greenhouse and let the sunlight come in, then the slime dries up, and the plants in there that you want them to grow, they can grow. Mindfulness is the light. The hindrances are the slime. And the seven factors of awakening are the beautiful flowers. So when we live without awareness and presence of what's happening here and now, when we're lost in our mind and our activity, it tends to support the growth of unhealthy qualities of mind and activity. That's a tendency of that. In the dark, that's what happens. In the light tends to support the growth of these beautiful qualities. These are called qualities of awakening, of enlightenment, of freedom. And much of what Buddhism is not teachings. It's not teachings about what is true, some kind of religious teachings. Buddhism is Buddhism is not a series of teachings about Buddhism. Buddhism is a series of instructions on awakening. And that's a very important distinction. And the sap that supports all the different schools of Buddhism, hopefully, is these seven factors of awakening. So when the mindfulness and so forth and equanimity are quite strong, remember, and equanimity is quite balanced. When the mind is not reactive, that's when the mindfulness sees the clearest. And when the mind is not non-reactive, very balanced, it feels a sense of well-being, tremendous tranquility, peace, non-reactive, very still, very quiet. There's something in the mind, there's an activity, there's a movement of the mind that the mind can do. I don't know if the can do is the right word. There's a transformation or a change or a flip or something that happened in the mind where the mind can let go in a very, very deep way that you cannot do. You cannot sit there and engineer the letting go. And these seven factors of awakening are preparing the stage for this equanimity, this peace, so that it's tremendous stillness. I don't have a good analogy for it, but imagine that there's a little ball, like a golf ball. Maybe it's like a golf ball, okay? And, some golfer has hit it across the green. And it's a funny ball, it's a windy day, whatever. And it kind of just goes this way and that way and, keeps going too fast. It goes over the hole because it's going too fast. And, then it goes by the hole and spins out again. But then it gets slower and slower and slower. At some point it gets so slow, at some point it's completely still so that it doesn't bypass the hole. It just falls right in. So that's not a good analogy, but something like that. At some point, the stillness is so profound that the mind doesn't miss that hole. Into freedom, into letting go, to a different level of opening, of liberation. And then one of the great things that happens in that kind of non-reactivity, a still place, is that many of the normal activities of mind that we use to support our life are put to rest, at least temporarily. So for example, the activity of always understanding our life from the point of view of a self. I'm here, you're there. I'm this kind of self, I have these needs, I have these desires, I have these... I need to be seen this way, I need to prove myself this way, I need to get to all these things. The world of desire, the world of constructing identities, the world of living in abstract concepts, which is what most people do much of the time, that world has a chance to be put to rest. And to experience our life free of concepts. Some people, just to be is one of the great experiences to have. And it creates a very different reference point for where we can find our happiness and well-being. To find that happiness and well-being in being, this radical kind of just sense of being without needing to build up anything at all, be anybody at all, then there's a tendency to make another distinction. The distinction is, which happiness is more satisfying? Most satisfying? Is getting another pair of shoes more satisfying? Or the equivalent? And you'll be amazed, maybe you already are quite amazed, at how amazing it is, how quickly the mind can get interested in everything else but awakening, but being free. Well, that's what I want. That's what I want, all these things. And partly it's because awakening, that state of mind, luminosity, that clarity, that openness of awakening, is not a thing. And so if it's not a thing, what good does it do for me? I can't sell it on eBay. For sale on eBay, Craigslist. My awakening. That doesn't work very well. So it's easy to overlook. So this fall, I talked a lot about the five factors of awakening, these darkening factors, and now this is the kind of conclude this long series. I wanted to offer you the other half, which is the other half being these beautiful qualities called the seven factors of awakening. It's said that one of the things that feeds or develops these seven factors of awakening is learning to recognize them. And that's one of the reasons it's important to teach them periodically. Because if we don't, if they're not taught or not talked about, it becomes going to be harder for people to appreciate when they're there. And they might be actually much more present for us in our lives than we realize it, than we realize. And sometimes it'd be quite subtle, but they're still there. And then, or sometimes I know people, I've known people who felt that meditation was supposed to be a obligatory, serious affair. It's supposed to be serious, you know, and sit down and get kind of grim and serious and serious, you know, Buddhist practice. And so they might feel a little bit of joy bubbling up, but no joy. I'm supposed to just let go, you know, let go of everything, you know, or joy, you know. When I was a Zen student, you know, joy, you know. No way, you know, I'm a serious Zen student, you know. Bodhidharma sitting here with the Bodhidharma smile, upside down smile. Just the truth. None of this kind of, you know, joy stuff. But joy, tranquility, equanimity are beautiful factors. You're not expected to let go of them. It's helpful to recognize their presence. Not necessarily, you don't want to get attached to them, cling to them, expect them. You don't want to be disappointed when they're not there. But to know, be familiar with what they are, and then be able to enjoy them, appreciate them, help support them, and helps them to grow. Remember that the slime grows in the dark, the beautiful plants grow in the light. The hindrances grow in the dark, and mindfulness grows, seven factors of awakening grow in the light of awareness and appreciation. So as we end this year, and we turn now towards the more light time of the year, may it be that your light can shine on these beautiful capacities that you have, that we all have, and may these beautiful capacities grow for you. And so next June, when it starts getting darker, you just keep getting lighter. So, we have about 10 minutes. Does anybody like to ask a question or make a comment?
What's the relationship between state of nirvana and equanimity?
In one of the classic equanimity, in the way it's talked about here, is an activity, is an activity of the mind. It's a functioning of the mind. And the experience of nirvana as experience of full awakening is not an activity. So there's no equanimity in nirvana. But however, in the classic classic Buddhist idea of the path to nirvana, to awakening, equanimity is the penultimate stage before nirvana. Equanimity is the penultimate stage before awakening. Because in order for the mind to drop into that hole of nirvana, mind has to be very equanimous and balanced, even. So it gets very close to it. Yes? You have the old one.
That answer suggests that these seven factors are hierarchical. Is that so?
Well, in the tradition, they talk about the seven factors of awakening in the way I did today sequential. They build on each other, and they talk about them as being a whole, all working all together, integrated together. It's both. And equanimity, but equanimity is discussed or appears in various places, various lists. And so when it appears in Seven Factors Awakening, it appears in one understanding or one way. When it appears as the penultimate stage before awakening, it's a different list. So it's got a different, little bit different understanding for it. There's something like, I don't know how many, half a dozen or more definitions of equanimity. It's like, they say that the Eskimos have all these words for snow. The Buddhists have all these definitions for equanimity. Different, parsing it out. Yes?
I'm coming from a place where it felt like the shadow side or the hindrances kind of have had a lot of power and been able to pull me under the quicksand, if you will. But I'm getting to a place where it feels like the skillful qualities are starting to gain strength, and I'm curious if it doesn't sound like there is, but is there like a boogeyman around the corner that's a hindrance that I don't know about or something that's going to kind of pull me back again? I mean, I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems like you kind of...
It's not a linear path. I mean, maybe there's a few unusual people, just like a linear path to better and better, you know, but most people, it's spiral and loops and, it's sometimes it's one step forward, two steps forward, one step back. Sometimes it's one step forward and three steps back. You know, it's all kinds of ways it works. But I think that it depends how you... It's very hard to measure or analyze or look at the path and how it develops for people. It's all good, as long as you're practicing. And sometimes it looks like you're going backwards because now I'm more agitated, I'm caught up in anger. But actually, maybe it's actually part of the process of going forward, having to deal with that anger. And so rather than going backwards, it's actually going forwards. There's so much. So are the boogeymen waiting for you? I think any serious path of practice will help you meet yourself really deeply. And so we'll find out what's in there. And if what we find are boogeymen, take that as a good sign. You know, great. Now I get to practice with it. It's a lot better to see it and practice with it than have it, back there, subconsciously doing its thing.
Thank you.
Did you read off the seven Pali words for the...
I didn't say the Pali words, no. Except for the joy thing.
Yeah. Could you do that? Is it possible? Briefly.
I can, but I don't quite... I was thinking earlier today, just before I gave the talk, and for some reason I'm a little embarrassed to say I don't think I can remember the Pali for the second one. But the first one is mindfulness of sati. The second one is, I think it's Dhamma Vichaya. I think that's what it is. And the third one is Virya. The fourth one is Titti. The fifth one is Pasadi. The sixth one is Samadhi. And the seventh one is Upekkha. Someday, perhaps you'll have a strong experience of conventional wakefulness. Wakefulness. So maybe you've had a nice, nice day, relaxed day. You take a little nap. You've had some good exercise. You have a little nap. You wake up. You feel rested. Nothing has to happen. you're just kind of there, beautiful sunlight is coming in through your window, and you just kind of, if you're really awake and clear, nothing has to happen. And the sense of wakefulness is really strong. Conventional wakefulness is really strong. I hope that you had that experience, or maybe someday have that experience, or hints of it. You might then, in that experience, look around in that experience, in that clarity or openness, and see if you can identify the seven factors of awakening. Is there almost naturally in that state some quality of mindfulness, of discernment, or this investigation, or kind of distinctions, of certain kind of energy or effort, certain kind of joy, delight, certain kind of tranquility? Maybe concentration is a little bit hard to see in that state, but maybe you can find it. equanimity. I'd like to suggest that these seven factors are not something that's so foreign to you. It's probably things that you do experience from time to time. They might be very subtle or small, but I think it's helpful to actually learn to identify them as they occur naturally in your life, rather than thinking that it's something you have to import from the outside or develop because you don't have them. So I wish you all a happy New Year, and those of you who want to have a meditative New Year, meditative New Year's Eve party event, and you can come here. And Birgit, for years now, has been doing a New Year's Eve event here. It's very nice, with poetry and sitting and stuff, and so that happens here. So, many thanks.